Welcome to The Weekly. I'm Jeremy.
I'm Chris.
This week on The Weekly, for headlines, we have Games Workshop going to Kickstarter and the Dragonlance authors suing Wizards of the Coast.
Interesting.
And for our topic this week, I thought we would discuss horror games on the tabletop. So how to play a horror setting or how to create that atmosphere while avoiding the Joker that's going to be breaking the mood.
Ooh, easy answer to that one.
Start with the first topic. So Games Workshop has announced that if you've got a strong vision of something you want to produce using our imagery and have a sound plan to make it a reality, then the people to talk to are our licensing department. So Games Workshop released that statement. And so now they are open to companies in a similar way that they were doing with games, where they're pretty free with the licensing.
For video games.
Yeah, for video games. So mobile and video games, a lot of trash kind of shovelware.
Really?
There's a lot of really random little casual games and odd stuff that just flooded out. It's gotten a lot better. I think they've gotten a little bit more discerning about who they're giving licenses to, and they've had more successes.
Right.
Now they're going to do the same thing with merchandise or things related to Warhammer that are going to then be allowed to crowdfund on Kickstarter.
How related? I'm wondering.
Well, the first one that we've seen is a Acadian Imperial Guard, similar to the Bandai, like maybe 12-inch kind of dolls.
The
figure. So very detailed Imperial Guard.
Like the big action figures?
Yeah, kind of like a, I don't know if it's posable or if it's a statue, but it's a very detailed Gideon Guard. And they've already done this on the website where they're licensing for like coffee mugs and t-shirts and things, you know, going to third parties to fulfill those. So this is maybe another extension of expanding their brand. But seeing Games Workshop branded things on Kickstarter is going to be a little strange.
Is it really any different from what we've talked about in Kickstarter before about how companies are moving in to use it as a pre-order when it was originally designed as something else? And although this is different, I kind of see it as another logical extension about like a big company with a noticeable IP saying, okay, we want another revenue stream. We maybe don't have the ability to produce these other third-party things or no desire to invest money in being able to produce these third-party things. Letting other people do that will get us money from them having to buy the IP license.
Yeah, that's right. Just having people pitch them ideas and they saying yay or nay. And then and then those companies, not even all they have to spend money on is the pitch.
Yep.
And then they crowdfund for the
So it's kind of sets Games Workshop up where the other companies don't really have to invest anything or don't really have to be all that big because they're going to crowdfund it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's a weird move. And we're seeing a lot of that, though. A lot of board game companies, there's so many licensed, basically video games or mobile game IPs that are now making a transition into board games. So there's a lot of Kickstarter board games that are based on video games and properties that, are kind of an odd conversion.
One of my popular phrases on the podcast is, from a business standpoint, it makes sense. Mm. Because if you already have the audience for these little mobile games or IP from video games, you're appealing to two different audiences, people who already know the property from whatever it's from, and people who are interested in board games.
And you have a lot lower a hurdle for getting somebody to pledge when they already know the property. Yep. They see some little minis and like, oh, wow, they made miniatures of these characters from the game. And it's a pretty easy sell. You just like, movie sequels and movie reboots. Mm-hmm. You've got that familiar title that people know. So you get them in the theater and get them to pledge the basic.
Not exactly the same thing, but I think I've seen a either news for or a Kickstarter for a Monster Hunter, the Capcom franchise Monster Hunter board game. It even kind of sucked me in because I'm like, you know what? Based on the old Fantasy Flight StarCraft game, where I was like, I don't know how you're going to translate StarCraft into a board game.
Oh, right.
And then being as impressed as I was and how, while the mechanics were different, it still felt like StarCraft. I actually looked at that Monster Hunter game. It's like, I am mildly interested. I'm probably not going to pledge because I just can't. And like the big models, like, oh, a 28-centimeter, scale Rathalos model. I'm like, looks cool. Mm. Not appealing to me because where am I going to store that damn thing? Anecdotal evidence where doing something like that gets people who are aware of the property interested in possibly backing your product.
Right. Yeah. And there's a Monster Hunter movie coming out. Did you see the Mila Jovovich, the husband and wife team that brought us all of those Resident Evil films?
You know what? Now that you mention it again, I heard about it and immediately said it's going to be trash.
Yes.
And then forgot about it, which is why my long silence there. Yeah. It's calling it now. It's not going to be good.
Right. Well, they've already, the trailer already showed a Humvee going through into an alternate dimension.
Oh,
so it's all like soldiers in the desert fighting monsters. The funny thing is, though, I mean, Games Workshop is like there's no risk involved. They're just greenlighting things. Unlike what Hasbro is doing, where they're creating their own kind of crowdfunding platform.
Oh, yeah. That HasLabs thing.
Yeah. Maybe if there's a lot of success with those things, Games Workshop may even consider that someday, like trying to crowdfund their own stuff. Because things that aren't, they're marginally popular.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe it's not respect, but I at least appreciate companies knowing what they're good at.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of knowing what they're not. And so I don't think Games Workshop has the infrastructure to make its own crowdfunding site. And then
they can't even make an app. Yeah.
Stick to what you're good at. Miniatures and overpriced war games.
Right. And our other headline this week, the Dragonlance authors are suing Wizards of the Coast. So authors Tracy Hickman and Margaret Weiss are suing Wizards of the Coast for breach of contract. So according to the court documents, so they were hired, prepared the licensing, did a contract for a new trilogy of novels to kind of complete their Dragonlance
run. Which I've never read.
Yeah, I started to read one and then said, there's a lot better books I should be reading.
Okay, yep.
in this genre that aren't Dungeons & Dragons. Never got into the, but I know that that's, you know, that
a,
is.
A fairly, it seems to be a fairly popular setting for the Dungeons & Dragons tabletop role-playing game.
Right.
But yeah.
And so they are seeking $10 million for this breach of contract because they had already submitted a draft or two, I think, of the first novel. And so they've already committed time to this and probably already, you know, turned down other work in preparation for this. So, of course, Dragonlance was developed by the original TSR publishers in the 80s. The novelizations kicked off in 1984 with the publication of Dragons of Autumn Twilight. And the original trilogy also included Dragons of Winter Night and Dragons of Spring Dawning. So I guess we got a seasonal theme.
Yeah. Summer Afternoon was the one that's missing?
A lot of things came from that. A lot of new races and things in the setting.
Everyone's favorite, the Kender.
So that's and that's a little bit of what they were talking about. And so that may be, according to the court documents, that seems like what Wizards of the Coast is doing is they've already kind of stepped in it a few times with their handling of both Magic and D&D.
Okay.
So they're just trying to avoid anything problematic that might be in Dragonlance. There was an editor that was probably was a little overzealous in trying to make this a very safe release. And I think things just fell apart.
Okay, so what I'm picking up, and I think what I've seen online, is worried about kind of reactions to this new series of novel. And I guess Wizards trying to sort of clean up its image based on sort of past missteps, especially when it comes to like diversity and stuff.
Right.
Someone looked at this and said, no.
I think certain elements of it, yeah. Okay. Because there were certain things like love potions and the portrayals of some of the races. They're like, yeah, we know there's going to be a reaction to this. Can we change that? And it was maybe too integral to the plot.
Okay.
And so there was a little conflict. So from the filing done by the authors, at nearly the exact same time from our termination, and they were terminated August 13th, Wizards informed them that they would not be approving any more drafts. The defendant embroiled, so defendant being Wizards, was embroiled in a series of embarrassing public disputes whereby its non-Dragonlance publications were excoriated for racism and sexism. Moreover, the company itself was vilified by well-publicized allegations of misogyny and racist hiring and employment practices with respect to the artists and employees unrelated to Dragonlance.
Mm-hmm.
So the plaintiff creators are informed and believe, based on based on the decision that was made jointly by the defendant and its parent company, Hasbro, to deflect any possible criticism of further public outcry regarding the defendant's other properties by effectively killing the Dragonlance deal.
Right. Okay. And now that I've heard that, because I had kind of been on the periphery of this and I saw someone mention, it kind of seems like Weiss and Hickman are saying, hey, Wizards is trying to like clean up their image. And so they canceled our book because it would hurt their image, whereas like, why would you sue a company over that? Like, I understand losing work and kind of turning down other work and maybe that, but your reasoning sounds like you're saying, because there were problematic elements in our stuff, our employer said they didn't want the book after being called to task on other problematic stuff.
Right. Where
it's kind of like, that's what you want to say?
That's it.
And I saw someone else online say, like, it seems like for once, Watsi and Hasbro kind of possibly did the right thing.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. And it seems like, because this, from what I've heard, this sort of corresponded with a release of the 5e version of the Dragonlance setting.
Okay.
So updated setting. And now they're realizing that so much of their old material is not going to play well, and they're going to have to kind of go through it and, you know, put warnings and do the kind of editing and things they've been doing recently. So they just gave up the whole idea. And is maybe part of a trend of Wizards of the Coast with D&D is moving away from settings. because, maybe. Yeah, that would help them. Because I heard an interesting argument online that said releasing settings is difficult because as you keep supporting those settings, you're limiting the audience. So if somebody's playing Dragonlance or somebody's playing Greyhawk or somebody's playing Forgotten Realms, and you release a book for that, that's you're losing everybody else that's playing other settings. So it's only groups and people that are involved. So if you release kind of setting neutral stuff that's very wide and just supporting, like the kind of collections that they've been doing more recently of updating rules, you know, adding spells and subclasses and things, then everyone will buy it.
Right. Okay.
So yeah, so marketing wise, they're probably thinking that way. And if they're getting all of this heat from things that played well in the 80s that they
don't
know. Yeah, they can't now.
Interesting, because I buy that argument. I don't know if WotC is going along with it, because obviously I don't work for WotC. I remember some of their other stuff, especially around like 4E, they were releasing settings or parts of settings and just kind of saying, oh, and now this race, especially like Dragonborn, like this race from which used to be the setting is now kind of canon and everywhere. And so things had to be like rewritten to include elements across like all of the settings, which I felt kind of flattened stuff, but did make it easier for people to like campaign jump from setting to setting. And I have no idea how frequently that happens.
Yeah. It's not a good sign for, you know, revival of old work, because it doesn't sound like Wizards of the Coast wants to deal with any of this, you know, as far as cleaning it up. So they're just going to cut it off. It'll be like the extended Star Wars universe. It does not exist.
Well, okay, when you put it that way, I have never read any of expanded universe stuff. I have no desire to. So are we losing all that much?
So WotC said, we are not moving toward breach of contract, but we will not be approving any further drafts. So they are not canceling anything, but they're saying that we are not in breach of contract. We are just kind of stonewalling them.
I wonder.
That's the result of this, is they're saying, because this fell apart, it was done, Wizards of the Coast, publisher, and the licensing department all working together to get this going. So we don't want a new trilogy. And basically that means all the stories and outlines and everything that was previously developed is just going to be locked away forever. Right. We're never going to see this. Yeah, it's never going to surface. That also might mean that they could bring in, once they figured out what they don't like about the setting or what, you know, what they want, what they don't want to market, they could bring in a third party, like an unofficial, like a non-official author, Dragonlance. So, because they own it.
I suppose they could do that.
So a little odd. Yeah.
Not, of course, like not exactly the same thing, but people are getting their Cortex Prime RPG handbooks. And I have two copies, one of which is a comp copy because I have a Spotlight that it hasn't come out yet, but a Spotlight is kind of like a setting, right? And my contract was to write something, and I went through like the first round of edits, but wasn't able to finish the first round of edits. And so I handed it off to someone else, right? So I don't know what the final product is going to look like. Hopefully it'll be kind of close to whatever I submitted. But I also understand that I fulfilled my part of the deal, and it's now owned kind of by someone else.
Right,
and so whatever they do with it is kind of up to them, because it's theirs now. So even though I'm sure this is much bigger for Weiss and Hickman, isn't that kind of the nature of being a freelancer a little bit? Where it's we produced this for you up to our contract, and it's now yours, and kind of whatever you end up doing with it.
As long as I've compensated you for it. Yeah. So I'm curious what that $10 million, because the contract wasn't for $10 million.
I'm sure it wasn't. And
unless they really expected those novels to sell.
Yeah, really. And I kind of understand suing for lost work and turning down other opportunities because you wrote this. Was that worth $10 million?
Mm, yeah. And the fact that they're including all of the kind of political and social media trouble that Hasbro and WotC are having is a little odd to bring that up in a court filing. So we'll see. We'll see how that plays. And that might set precedent for other future kind of business maneuvers, because if it favors the big guys in this, then everyone's going to be in trouble.
I don't like the fact that I then had to go on record kind of defending WotC.
You did. And I'm going to
happy about that. So thanks a lot, Dragonlance authors.
Okay, so moving on to our topic for this week, we're talking about horror on the tabletop. So horror in a tabletop role-playing game. What's been your experience so far? Well, the interesting thing about that is almost any setting, any system, any campaign can have horror elements. Yeah. I mean, dungeon crawling can be very horrific, and our Alien game has a lot of horror elements to it. I mean, that keeps coming up, and even Monster Hearts.
Yeah.
As much as it's teen high school romance, it can be pretty horrific because of the monster nature of the characters.
For me, one of the big distinctions between kind of a different type of game and a horror game is how much power the protagonists have.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as you mentioned, like dungeon crawling or D&D, you're playing heroes, mm-hmm. right? You're very capable. And so even things that are scary, your characters are expected to be able to deal with them.
Right.
Which is,
right.
I think, why it doesn't skew towards horror. Mm-hmm. Where it does skew towards horror is the protagonists are largely powerless.
Mm.
Like, for example, a good example is like the Aliens game we mm-hmm. played. Similar to the Alien movie, the characters are vastly out of their element and don't really have the tools to be able to be on a level footing with what's going on. Right. And knowing that, I think, is what makes it a horror game.
Mm-hmm.
That is how you would make kind of any tabletop game a horror game, and why I think horror is a genre of game that's not for everybody.
Yeah,
or right, you right. really should spring on your players.
Yes.
Because it can be a whole lot of no fun to have kind of not ineffective, but vastly outclassed
yes.
characters.
Right, right. It is an interesting problem to solve. I think there's fun ways to play in that, but you're right. It can't be something you surprise characters with. You know, basically the types of horror. So there's, you know, survival horror, mm. which I think, you know, Alien or a lot of the things where you're dealing with something unexpected and you have limited resources and right. limited ways to fight it. So you're not heroic characters. You're not well equipped. You don't know what you're getting into. And then psychological horror, you know, gothic horror.
Mm.
And cosmic horror. So
to play gothic horror, mm-hmm. if my paperback novels have taught me anything, yes. you're a woman in a flimsy dress at night running away from a big old brooding manor.
Right.
Because that's like the classic gothic horror novel cover. Yeah.
Right. So what we're talking about, like, you're not surprising players with it. There has to be buy-in.
Yeah.
Like people
yeah.
have to go with it. Like I said in the introduction, like, you got a jokey player at the table that's just going to be making fun of everything. It's going to really undermine any atmosphere.
You bring that up. And yes, a player who's going to constantly joke can ruin the atmosphere. However, I think telling jokes and lightening the mood is a natural reaction to kind yes. of horror and feeling uncomfortable, and why horror movies, which I'm kind of coming around to, have those jump scares that then turn mm-hmm. out to be a cat
mm-hmm.
or you know, something not scary, or the characters bump into each other, whatever. Because right. if it's just all scary
oh, yeah.
all the time, it's not fun.
Right. Yeah, that's true. So there are certain games you're going to go into, like Call of Cthulhu or the Alien RPG, where you know there's horror elements. You know you're going to be encountering things, and that atmosphere is going to be part of it. If you are making characters specifically to be dealing with that, or you know that are going to do that, maybe you aren't going to be so attached to them as you would have been with something in a campaign that you want to see them build up, because you know they're going to be confronted with, you know, sanity rules or, you know, or instant death. Yeah, I think having expendable or disposable characters does a little bit take that away, because the player is like not wanting their characters to die, I think is an important part of that.
I think,
or the buy-in, I think.
Yeah, yeah. You definitely have to buy in. And I guess the flip side of that is having characters you know are going to be disposable, unless you're running like some kind of meat grinder where the fun is watching these characters get chewed up, which right. can be.
Yeah.
You do need to have some attachment to the characters. Otherwise, it's not going to matter when you feed them into the meat grinder.
Right, and you might just make stupid decisions.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I think Trophy, which can be a horror game. Trophy is often described as play to lose, where I think the buy-in and the enjoyment of that game is, okay, we know our characters are largely going to be fucked.
Right.
That's not the question. The question is how they get there and kind of watching them get there. That can be a type of horror game, and I think that can be important buy-in to making a character you not necessarily like, but kind of want to see on screen
right.
and kind of want to see them, how they get to this point. Because the last game of Trophy I played at one of the Jig RPG days, they were a horrible person. And that was a snap decision I made. And so I'm not going to say a character you like
right.
because, I don't like this character, but I'm interested in seeing what they do when confronted with these things.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, so do you think a one-shot or kind of a campaign works better with horror?
I guess the benefit of a one-shot is you can kind of throw everything in that session. And by throw everything, I mean throw everything at the characters and not have to pull back. But I think there could also be, depending on the type of horror, especially if it's psychological, a campaign could be fun, though hard to maintain, where you could use like psychological, again, with player buy-in. You could use psychological, drawing a blank on the word, but basically you could kind of gaslight the characters, which is a part of psychological horror
right.
where, okay, yeah, that thing that happened two sessions ago, here's what actually happened.
Right, right.
Or it would be hard to do, but you could do it, and you could only do it in a campaign
yeah,
where you could look at past events in kind of a different light that end up being horrific. Like, oh no, that wasn't a whatever you killed. It was actually a person.
Right, right.
Good luck with that. Yeah.
Yeah. And one thing when I was reading about horror on the tabletop, one game that kept coming up is Dread.
Okay.
Using the Jenga tower. So I think that kind of, that makes a mechanical, that, you know, that kind of takes a little bit of the burden off of the GM because you have this thing that's breaking down and is going to make a loud sound, you know, when it collapses.
Oh yeah, yeah. I hadn't considered that. I see Dread is kind of like the stress dice in Alien RPG, right, where you have an outside mechanic that the player is kind of aware of that heightens the tension of the game, where using that tumbling block tower to pull blocks from to see if you're successful is a metagame mechanic where the player is feeling some of the tension of not knocking that tower over, which I think is really cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, definitely. The one thing, though, about the Jenga tower, when I was thinking about that and the different games it's been applied to, is it almost needs to make some sort of mechanical sense. What's the sci-fi game that uses it? It's like the last scene of Alien and you're fixing the ship.
Oh, The Wretched.
Yeah, The Wretched.
The Wretched, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so when I was thinking about the Wretched, so that makes sense if you're doing something mechanical, you're doing something to fix the ship and it could go wrong. Mm-hmm. But in certain things like where your, I don't know, your emotional state or something, that's a little too abstract for me as far as like a Jenga tower. Like there seems to be something that motion or that the physicality needs to connect to.
I see what you're saying. Yeah. There are some settings or some styles of game where pulling a block from the Jenga tower will kind of take you out of the moment.
Right.
But I guess it's kind of the same as like rolling dice
or
drawing a card. But there is a different, while it's similar, there's a different tactile feel to it and a different kind of psychological feel to it that kind of should be taken into account.
Right.
So yeah, I totally see that. Some of the better games I've seen, it could all be emotional state. Mm-hmm. And then the collapse of the tower represents a breakdown.
Right, right.
Or one version, I think you were of the Wretched, you were building a life raft. And instead of pulling blocks, you built a tower up. And
if
it fell, it was game over.
Right,
so
right.
There are things you can do with it. But yeah, I see your point.
So would you consider only the setting or actually the entire, like the mechanics and everything of something like World of Darkness being a horror game?
It could be either and or both, which is which is a wishy-washy answer. But I remember from running Ubiquity and simultaneously running a vampire game, I remember Chris one time said he was afraid to have his character do things in Vampire because the dice chances of success were so much lower than they were in Ubiquity. And this was years ago, and that's one of the things that could kind of flip the switch of, oh, system matters.
Right.
Because they were both dice pool mechanics and you were essentially kind of, you know, you totaled up your dice and you rolled them and counted successes.
Mm-hmm.
But where Ubiquity is 50-50, World of Darkness was like 70%, like 7 plus on a D10. And just that change made one game horror or feel more horror and one game feel more pulp.
Interesting. Yeah, no, that's a really good point, though. Chance of success is, yeah, if it's against you, then it definitely feels, yeah, much more. Interesting, because I was thinking about that, because there are, you know, settings of games and you're playing vampires and werewolves and things, but it doesn't necessarily have to be horror, you know,
no,
because you're normal. That's the normal state of the world, yeah.
Even just kind of like player reaction, because bringing up Monster Hearts, I mean, we had people eating hearts.
Right.
out of a still-warm corpse in Monster Hearts game, and how the characters reacted to that, I think, determined whether it was horror or comedy.
Right.
And in our game, it was a horrific and kind of violent act, but it ended up being kind of humorous.
Yeah, no, that's true. I think that, yeah, the reaction of the table, yeah, has a lot to do with that, definitely. As that example, the Alien RPG, I listened to a lot of actual plays of that, and there was such a huge range of people that, you know, they really like quietly, very tensely, like moved through this spaceship, you know, examining doors and kicking piles of debris and things. Mm-hmm. And we just kind of walked and talked.
Again, having run that game a couple times now and played in it, one of my favorite questions is, do your characters have any reason to move quietly?
Right.
And to their credits, the players I have had have looked at each other and said, as characters, no.
Right.
We're just like, okay, well, that's the game we're playing. I've not lucked into any Alien RPG actual plays that didn't come off as kind of comical to me. And I've not been able to kind of listen to them and hang with them. So I'll have to try and look for some more.
I was surprised by the range. And I think, you know, people want different things out of games and have different kind of predisposition going into certain settings. You know, because in Alien, we talked about that, you know, you are definitely seeing, you're going to encounter a xenomorph. So at what point is that going to happen?
Or not, you're going to encounter something else.
Right.
Xenomorph adjacent.
Right, that's right. That's right. Something else that is not quite, but could have been a prototype of,
Yeah.
But if you are considering for this, you know, the Halloween season, playing a horror game, yeah, think about some of those ways that you have to plan for character buy-in or plan, you know, what you can do in a campaign versus a one-shot, because I think it'll make a big difference in the game. And there's actually a very interesting essay written by Ash Law called The Trajectory of Fear.
Ooh.
That talks about how to build fear and gives examples from movies. And this basically could be applied to writing, but the writer makes specific examples of how this works on tabletop and how you should use it. And just like you were talking about, you can't have constant terror, or because it'll become farcical or just ridiculous, or people can't stay tense that long, so they're going to start joking. The writer talks about the four fears and how to use these, you know, use these in a tabletop session and kind of the balance, the trajectory, I mean, of the title, of how these things work. And so just briefly, the four fears are unease, dread, terror, and horror. So unease would be the starting point. So it's the knowledge of something that is not right in the world. Dread is a suspicion, unconfirmed, that something is not right and is here. It is more immediate and more focused than unease. Terror is the most powerful type of fear because of its immediacy. Terror is the sure knowledge that something terrible is imminent and that the danger is here but has not yet been revealed. And then, of course, horror is the most immediate and primal type of fear, but paradoxically the weakest. So horror is the revelation, meeting the danger and discovering the boogeyman. Horror is the punchline of fear and the thing that elicits gasps and jumps. So the thing that's done really well in this essay is there are direct examples from movies like, Blair Witch or Alien or things that you can relate to, movies that you've seen, that talk about how that building tension works, how you start with unease into dread into terror. And it's very similar to the narrative curve where things have to build and then be relieved. And terror is the, like they say, the punchline or the release of that building dread, that building terror. So I'll put a link to that in the description. And I think it's well worth checking out because it'll give you a good idea if you want to run something on the tabletop, at least how to pace things and how to overuse certain types of fear. And they give good examples about what too much of one thing becomes, too much unease or too much dread or too much horror, what that turns into. And I think that's an important thing to keep balanced and to pace your sessions and build and then release and then continue to keep the players uneasy, continue that state so that you can, you know, build to terror again. That was a very good way to analyze how horror works and especially specifically applying it to the tabletop. So as we said, with all the different settings, you know, types of characters or types of games you can play, you still have to orchestrate how the tension works in the game and how things build and how things are released so that it's not, you don't try to sustain something for too long and then it kind of breaks down or loses its effectiveness. So take a look at that in the description. That's Trajectory of Fear by Ash Law. So where can people find you?
On Twitter, as always, where I am going through Tamsin Muir's Harrow the Ninth.
Ah, book. Uh-huh.
No spoilers because I'm still going through it. But yeah, that's Hivemind, Hyvemynd, which interspersed with parroting tweets too. So just ignore those if you want to.
If you'd like to support The Weekly, please visit idleredhands.com. You can support us both on Patreon or with either recurring or one-time donation. So that's it for this week. We'll be back next week.
Later, mortals.
Bye.